Now, hold on to your hat for a very interesting fact. You are 90% not you. Well, it's true. Only 10% of the cells in our body are human cells, and it's said the other 90% belong to the bacteria, viruses, and fungi that live within us. We need these communities of critters to live our lives, but sometimes they go bad and turn against us. When bacteria turn against us and begin to eat us, we fight them off with poisons we call antibiotics. But it turns out that bacteria are very clever critters and quickly develop a resistance to antibiotics, which leaves us vulnerable to their depredations. This vulnerability leads us to ask, how do bacteria learn to resist antibiotics?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 963rd edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Todos Santos who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. But whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
Also with us today, we have producer Anna Ringelman. Hello, Anna.
Good morning.
And producer Kristen Carlson.
Good morning.
Folks, for the couple weeks here, we're giving wings to our fledgling producers from the University of California, giving them the opportunity to pick up and fly, as it were, on the Food Chain Radio program. And interestingly enough, both Anna and Kristen have selected shows that talk about resistance. And so today, that's exactly what we're going to do. And Kristen is going to lead us today with a conversation about bacteria and how bacteria develop resistance. Kristen, it's all yours. Take it away.
All right. Folks, most of us in the food and health circles have heard of the importance of probiotics, which provide our body with a boost of beneficial bacteria, almost like little helpers. Some of us may also be aware of the dangers of the development of antibiotic-resistant strains of harmful bacteria, creating runaway bugs and in some cases leaving doctors with little to no options for treatment of specific diseases, life-threatening diseases such as MRSA, for example. So we do the best we can with the information we have, and if we're good, we take our probiotics or eat fermented foods to load our gut with those little nice guys. But what really is the relationship between these microscopic good guys and bad guys? How can we best protect ourselves and future generations from these antibiotic-resistant superbugs? And how do we get them and keep them on our side and in our gut? Here to help us answer some of these questions and many more, we have Dr. Gautam Dantas, the principal investigator at Washington University at St. Louis, researching microbial genomics, ecology, biochemistry, and synthetic biology. Welcome to the Food Chain, Gautam.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So to start off, could you please explain to us and to our listeners what microbial genomics is?
Sure. So most people are familiar with this concept that all living things have DNA. They're the building blocks of how we're put together. They happen to exist in these particular segments called genes, and genes are the action units. They would create proteins. Mm-hmm. And all of the genes in a particular organism are collectively called a genome. And so microbial genomics then is the study of the collective genes, all of the genes in a particular organism, and in this case, all of the genes of particular microbes.
Okay, and so it looks like there are infinite directions that you could possibly go with this study, is that right?
Oh, that's absolutely right. I think largely because of the fact that all DNA is governed by the principles of evolution, and so starting out with any particular DNA sequence, you can now essentially infinitely evolve into different sequences.
And what are some examples of different studies in microbial genomics?
Sure, there's perhaps the revolution in microbial genomics, this idea of looking at all genes at the same time, occurred around the late 90s to the switch of the early 2000s when large-scale DNA sequencing came on board. So one of the early revolutionary studies was Craig Venter and his group sequencing as many of the microbes in the ocean as they could find, and this was in the early 2000s. And a large deliverable from that study was emphasizing that microbial diversity is much, much, much more immense than we had previously seen. So when they went and sequenced the genomes of many of these ocean microbes, they, for instance, more than doubled the database of known proteins at the time with one experiment.
Wow. Wow. So is it fair to say that the scientific community were sort of like on just the cusp, the cutting edge of understanding the microbial communities?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think to say that we were on the cusp, maybe even overstating the claim, I think we really had not appreciated deeply how diverse and immense and wonderful microbial communities are before we started looking at these communities as communities, first of all. And so just to take a step back, generations now, we've considered microbes as single organisms, looked at them one at a time, mm-hmm. but we now recognize that they live in communities, and then extending that further to understand that all of their genes together do lots of amazing things in concert.
Right. So I had read in one of your papers about horizontal gene transfer, and I was surprised by the different forms that happens, and really, it made me think it's amazing that they haven't built up resistance quicker, because there's different ways to transfer these genes. Could you tell us a little bit about horizontal gene transfer?
Of course. Yeah, I think most people are familiar with the idea of vertical evolution. So this is this way that all of us evolve, how all of us give rise to our progeny. So, you know, humans can only pass their genes on to their kids, and then those kids onto their kids. Microbes happen to also be able to do that. They can vertically pass on DNA and mutations, but they can also do this thing called horizontal gene transfer, which is the process of two cells, two microbial cells, two bacterial cells, able to pass genes directly from one to the other. So this would be akin to something, obviously, that we can't do, but the sort of analogy would be if I wanted blue eyes suddenly, I would borrow the genes from someone who has blue eyes, and suddenly my eyes would turn blue. Obviously, we know that doesn't happen with humans, but essentially exactly that type of trait transfer can occur with microbes. As you said, there are quite a few different ways in which this occurs. There are three major mechanisms. One is called transduction. This is the ability to move DNA between two different microbes through viruses. So phages, which are viruses that infect bacteria, they move DNA between two cells. A second one is conjugation. And so this one describes the process of direct physical transfer. So one cell contacts another cell, usually through the process of a pilast, and then there's a direct transfer of DNA. And this actually won Joshua Lederberg the Nobel Prize for demonstrating this many decades ago. And then the final process is transformation, which is the ability of a select few microbes to take up free DNA. So say a set of cells die in the environment, these other cells can come along, these other bacteria can suck up their DNA. And so those three different processes, bacteria that are quite different from each other, can exchange traits by exchanging genes.
And so I want to talk to you more about phages a little bit later. But so your research has, a big portion of it has been in the buildup of antibiotic resistance. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So to start off, we recognize that we had this massive change in our ability to get over infectious disease burdens about a century ago, probably starting with chemicals like arsenic and a few other sulfur drugs in the early 1900s, and then the amazing discovery of penicillin in the late 1920s started this process of incredible discovery of these compounds, which we call antibacterials or antibiotics. Almost all of the novel classes of drugs that we use in the clinic today were discovered between the 1940s and the 1960s. Now, one interesting point before we get to resistance is to recognize that almost all of those compounds were discovered by natural product discovery. So that is people going into the soil and finding bacteria that happen to have this incredible ability to produce compounds which can kill other bacteria, and we call them antibiotics. And then we started using these natural compounds at higher concentrations to kill pathogens. Antibiotic resistance then is the response that the bacteria had when we started dumping these antibiotics on them. And that is, initially the drugs worked because the initial bacteria was susceptible, they could be killed. But very quickly, because of these processes of evolution, both vertical and horizontal gene transfer, bacteria started evolving resistance to those drugs so that we could no longer use them. And then once the drug-resistant bacteria evolved, they started passing those genes on to other susceptible bacteria, rapidly starting this resistance spread process.
Okay, thank you, Gautam. We're going to take a quick break. This is the Food Chain Radio. Phones 800-624-2665.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high value specialty crops for the city at metrofarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at metrofarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at metrofarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at metrofarm.com. That's metrofarm.com.
Welcome back. This is Food Chain Radio, here with Gautam Dantas, Principal Investigator at St. Louis University, at Washington. Dr. Dantas, we were talking about antibiotic resistance, and what's going on right now with the production of antibiotics?
Sure. So antibiotics are produced all over the world. There happens to be, like most drugs, a little bit of a disproportionate amount of especially generic drugs being produced in developing countries. So India and China produce a large number of drugs which are used around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of what they're used for, the rough estimates are something like 80 to 90% of antibiotics globally by weight are used as growth promoters for animals. And about 10 to 20% of antibiotics are used in the clinic to treat humans.
So what does that mean for us that we're using that much, that portion of antibiotics on animals for not clinical use?
Sure. So I think there's fairly clear evidence that the large amount of antibiotic use in animals certainly causes an increase in antibiotic resistance in animal-associated bacteria. So just to keep in mind here, we're not talking about antibiotic use in animals for their therapeutic use. They use primarily at these sub-therapeutic concentrations to allow them to grow a little bit bigger so that meat is, in effect, a little bit cheaper. So the grave concern with that in terms of us in the clinic is, since we're using exactly the same classes of drugs in our animals at these extremely high amounts, that the selection of resistance in animal-associated bacteria will cause those bacteria to eventually transfer over and cause problems in humans.
And you had done some soil studies. What did you find with that?
Sure, yeah. So we've done a couple of soil studies now. The one that you're probably referring to was published a couple of years ago, where we decided to look at resistance genes in non-pathogenic bacteria in the soil. As you probably know, most bacteria actually don't cause disease. This is a tiny fraction that do. But certainly because of this process of horizontal gene transfer, potentially genes can move between pathogens and non-pathogens. So we decided to look at a few different soils in the U.S., 11 soils in particular, and interrogated non-pathogenic bacteria there for drug resistance. And so we found that, A, a lot of drug-resistant bacteria do live in the soil, and this probably reflects ancient pressure because antibiotics are made there.
Mm-hmm.
But what we found, which was particularly surprising, was that those multi-drug-resistant bacteria had genes that were exactly the same as those that have been found in pathogens. They had the same resistance genes that have been found in bacteria that cause disease in humans. And this was surprising, partly because people had looked for this feature before but hadn't found it.
Wow. I'm sorry, keep going.
No. Just a wrap-up thought that the reason that this was particularly problematic was not only did we find those identical resistance genes, we found them in clusters. So we found them as multi-drug resistance clusters flanked by exactly the signatures which we know allow bacteria to go through as horizontal gene transfer. And so what this says is that not only are we finding evidence of the same genes, but we're finding evidence of the mechanisms by which these genes can move between the environment and the clinic.
And what do you think is causing that transfer into the soil?
So first of all, we're not sure based on our evidence which direction it goes. So we don't know whether it's going from pathogen to soil or soil to pathogens, but
okay.
We think both possibilities are alarming. I think because we don't know which direction, we have to sort of treat those two things separately. The reason for expecting pathogenic resistance genes to end up in the soil is essentially human contamination, right? We have immense amounts of waste that we produce, and those waste streams through wastewater treatment, for instance, eventually the fate of those solids and liquid wastes is to be dumped out into the environment. And
mm-hmm.
so we have all of that selection pressure where genes that are enriched in human-associated communities could end up in the environment. And it's also not surprising that that occurs because our conventional methods have tested wastewater treatment for bacteria that can grow, right? So we keep treating our waste until we say, oh, I can't get something to grow up anymore. But we're talking here about genes, so the DNA is never assayed for to see whether resistance genes are still around. So that might be dumped into the environment. And the reason you might see the opposite, that is soil bacteria dumping genes sort of back into the clinic, is because there happen to be these specialized bacteria, again, a tiny minority
mm-hmm.
in the soil that have the ability to live in both habitats. So bacteria like Pseudomonas and Acinetobacter, some types of E. coli, they happen to be able to live equally well in the soil as well as in the clinic.
Okay.
And then when we have, for instance, antibiotic use in agriculture, you provide selection pressure for resistance to enrich in the soil, and then it could potentially hop back into the clinic.
And do you know about the prevalence of E. coli 0157H7?
No, I don't know about the prevalence of that in the environment.
Oh.
Certainly, 01587 has been found to be pathogenic, and when it does end up in the food stream, it can cause pretty severe diarrhea, and in some cases, it's a few percent of the cases can be fatal. But I don't know what the spread of it is in the environment in terms of actual abundance numbers.
Okay. So you've also done some research into children and antibiotics. And the use of antibiotics in children age 5 and under, could you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Sure. To start out, there's been a lot of retrospective analysis by others to show that the 5-year age bin, where in the U.S. We dump the most amount of antibiotics into the human population, is in our kids. That is to say, from age, from birth through 5 years of age, that set of individuals gets more antibiotics per capita than at any other age bin. So that says that we've got the greatest selection pressure for antibiotic resistance in kids. Secondly, we also recognize from work of others that the bacteria that live in and on our bodies, right, this commensal human microbiota, as it's called, is established at birth. So we're all born sterile. And then there's this incredible process of us being colonized by effectively these good bacteria. But that process is extremely dynamic during the first few years of life. And then by about age three, things stabilize. And so you take those two particular facts. That is, you've got this fragile, important ecosystem of bacteria getting set up during the first few years of life at exactly the time that we're dumping a lot of antibiotics into these kids. Add on the third fact that, again, retrospective analysis has suggested that much of that use in kids is unwarranted. That a lot of times kids are getting antibiotics for what are clearly viral infections, which the antibiotics are going to do nothing for. Mm-hmm. So with those three things in mind, we decided to investigate whether these good bacteria in the guts of children and their intestinal microbiota, whether those bacteria have been enriched for antibiotic resistance, and what do those resistance genes look like. And so we published a pilot study last year on 22 kids. From 0 to 3 month old infants all the way up to 18 and 19 year olds. And the take home message, without getting on all the details, was that we found an immense amount of resistance, of functional antibiotic resistance, in the healthy microbiota of these kids. So to give you numbers, between these 22 kids, we identified roughly 2,000 different unique antibiotic resistance genes.
Wow.
Which is, to put that in perspective, that's about 1/8 the size of all known antibiotic resistance genes in the resistance databases.
Wow. That's big. We will pick this up in just a moment. We're going to take a quick break. Food Chain Radio, Kristen Carlson with Gautam Dantas. Phones 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080 on the Food Chain forums at metrofarm.com. Welcome back. This is Kristen Carlson with Gautam Dantas. We're talking about antibiotic resistance. Gautam, you said a pretty stunning number for the amount of resistance in children. Could you just take us back to those numbers again?
Sure, yeah. So when we did this pilot study of 22 healthy kids aged from infants to 19 years of age last year, we found in their gut microbiota, in their quote-unquote good bugs in their body, collectively those 22 kids harbored roughly 2,000 unique antibiotic resistance genes, which is about 1/8 or 1/6 of the total number of resistance genes in our resistance databases at that time.
So what does that say about, you know, setting up these kids for the future and being coming into contact with pathogens later on in their life?
Right. Now, this is a bit of a double-edged sword. So on one hand, this is really problematic. It suggests that these kids are loaded up with bacteria with lots of resistance genes. They're good bacteria, which means when a pathogen comes through their body, if that pathogen happens to start out susceptible, those pathogens now through horizontal gene transfer might pick up resistance genes from the good bugs.
Right.
And now become resistant. But the reason I said it's a double-edged sword is because if, for instance, our good bugs didn't have any resistance genes, then when we took antibiotics, we'd wipe all those good bugs out. So what we're trying to understand now is getting away from this black and white picture and understanding when is it okay to have some amount of resistance in these good bugs, especially in a way in which it could be in the good bugs but not accessible to pathogens.
So that takes us into the gut and my next question about when we take an antibiotic, we take this pill, it goes down. Are we completely wiping out a whole community, all the community? What sort of effects are we having on the bacteria in our stomach when we take antibiotics?
Sure. So the devil, of course, is in the details of the specific drugs, the concentrations you take, and how long you take it. So at the base level, when people have done studies of, say, a single drug for a certain amount of time in adults, there was a study from David Relman's group from Stanford about 6 or 7 years ago, where they looked at ciprofloxacin, so one of these extremely important fluoroquinolone drugs, and they saw what happened to the microbiota when people took this drug and then looked at changes before, during, and after. And they found that immediately after taking the drug, there's a huge rearrangement of the bacteria in the gut. Lots of minor bacteria become major, lots of major bacteria become minor. But that in most cases, if these humans did not have any other pathologies, once the drugs were taken away, the gross architecture of who was there in terms of the microbes reset by about a week or so, and then seemed to be overall stable. However, there were some minor members that still never reappeared almost a year or up to 4 years later. So that suggested that there are clearly persistent changes in the microbiota, even though the most dramatic changes are transient. So that's, on one hand, that's probably what happens to most of us. But then there are the extreme cases. And so you've probably heard of this particular pathogen called C. difficile or C. diff. This is one of the three most urgent threats, pathogen threats identified by the CDC in their report at the end of last year. So C. diff actually is something that most of us carry in our guts, but it's maintained at extremely low levels. It just so happens to be extremely drug resistant. So what happens is when people are immunocompromised, if you go in for surgery, for instance, and you have to take a lot of antibiotics to try to protect you from infections, if you now suppress a large amount of your good bacteria, C. diff can bloom up and can become fatal.
Oh, wow.
So those are the sort of extremes of what you might expect in terms of antibiotic effect. Small amount of antibiotics for a small amount of time in a mostly healthy human, you're going to get changes, but you'll more or less bounce back, even though you might enrich for resistance genes. If you're immunocompromised and you have a large amount of broad-spectrum antibiotics, it can cause such a disturbance that even something that was otherwise in your good bugs could kill you.
So in the alternative sort of health circles, I hear a lot of talk about building up your environment, building up your good bacteria. Is it possible that having a strong you know, floral bacterial in your gut could help prevent virulence with pathogens?
I think at the theoretical level, there's absolutely no question that that's true. So people have shown time and time again that one of the major roles of the human microbiota is prevention of pathogen intrusion. It's one of the main things that they do, and it's this particular process called colonization resistance. They are, in a sense, being selfish. They don't want to give up their niche, and so they exclude the pathogen, which ends up being really good for us. And in fact, the example I gave you with C. diff is exactly the process of that breaking down, right? If you disturb the good guys enough, they're going to let the bad guys come in, if you will. Now, the notion of using probiotics or prebiotics to restore a healthy microbiota has had some amount of success, but I think before we know exactly what the sort of good probiotics might be, we need a little bit of work. And so, again, I think the cases where it's sort of black and white, where restoring a microbiota has clearly helped better than even drugs, again, is in the case of C. difficile. So in this case of C. diff, when these people have this bloom of this pathogen, they're about to die. You've probably heard of this treatment called fecal transplant therapy, which is about as icky as it sounds. But actually, it's not icky because it's all cleaned up. But it's the idea that you restore one person's, almost destroyed gut intestinal microflora, microbiota, but transplanting it from someone else. And where does our microbiota reside? In our fecal matter. And so, and it's amazing how well this works. So you
really?
Can take people who are bedridden, who would literally be considered, weeks away from passing away from the C. diff infection. They're given an infusion of a cleaned up fecal material from a healthy donor. And this could be an arbitrary healthy donor. It doesn't have to be someone they're related to. Mm. So a physician decides when this is appropriate. They give this fecal transplant. And these people could now be walking around in a couple of days. It is amazing.
Wow.
Now, we have to be cautious. This is not something that you want to do willy-nilly anytime you feel the gastrointestinal distress come up.
And not at home.
And not at home. It's something which, of course, for that reason, you know, the FDA is taking very seriously. They're beginning to investigate how this works, why it works. It's clear with that dramatic example that over and over again, this has been shown to be extremely efficacious. Now, what we'd like to figure out is what are maybe milder maladies that could still be treated with this idea of prebiotics, and more research needs to be done for that.
Well, thank you, Gautam. We are going to take another quick break right here. But before we do, I wanted to ask you one thing to think about before we come back. Is it possible to transfer some of the beneficial traits onto pathogens to make them less powerful?
Sure, yeah, we'll talk about it when we come back.
Okay, thank you. This is the Food Chain Radio Show, Kristen Carlson with Gautam Dantas of Washington University at St. Louis. Phones 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080 on the Food Chain Forums at metrofarm.com. Welcome back to the Food Chain Radio, Kristen Carlson with Gautam Dantas. So before we left off, I asked a question, but Anna, she has a question for you as well.
Hello. So I just wanted to ask, because usually in the medical community, everything is about, you know, being very sterile. So I just wanted to ask, how commonly is fecal material transfer utilized by the medical community?
Sure. That's a very good question about sterility. Fecal transplant is something that is a work in progress. The first few clinical trials on this process just happened in the last year or so, some in the U.S. and some in Europe. I would say it's currently only used in dramatic cases of C. difficile blooms, and so not something that is routinely used for anything else. But I think it's about to grow and get used even more and more for treatment of things like C. difficile infections. And one of the reasons for that is because some of these clinical trials actually had to be stopped early because the effect of the fecal transplants was so dramatic that it was considered unethical to keep the placebo folks off the trial.
Wow, thank you.
Of course.
So going back to the question, can beneficials transfer to pathogens? What have you researched into that at all?
Yeah, so that's an interesting concept. We haven't done anything directly with trying to engineer any pathogens just because, I mean, even just saying that phrase is scary, right, to make any modifications to a pathogen. And so what we've done is tried to address that sort of conceptually as opposed to in exactly that same framework. And what I mean by that is we have considered the idea of taking bacteria that are closely related to pathogens but are not pathogenic themselves, mm-hmm. Which would be akin to taking a pathogen and removing its pathogen genes, and try to figure out a way in which they might be introduced when a pathogen might be suspected of infecting you, or even after it's infected you, to try to outcompete them. This is this concept where, you know, say you find an infectious E. coli, and you think, for instance, you're going to get traveler's diarrhea when you happen to go to a high infection rate place. Then maybe what you do is you give each of those travelers a probiotic that has a non-infectious E. coli, which they carry with them, or maybe have in a yogurt or something like that. And that way, perhaps, by having an extremely close related strain, but without any of the virulence, any of the pathogenesis, it'll be able to outcompete it based purely on a numbers game and then reduce the effect of the pathogen. And so I know that's not a direct answer to your question. It's not an engineering-based answer. In terms of changing the pathogen itself, but I think, you know, in spirit, it's the same idea. Take a non-virulent version of a bug and use it to fight off the virulent version.
So we had Dr. Daphne Miller on the show a few weeks back, and she just wrote her book, Pharmacology, and she talks a lot about the transfer of soil bacteria into food and how that sort of colonizes our gut. And so how exactly does diet affect the composition of flora in the gut?
Oh, it impacts it massively. And so there's been a lot of work by many researchers, but one of the leading folks, Jeffrey Gordon, is actually the director of the center that I work in. And they've shown fairly conclusively, both in humans and also in animal models of humans, that food, the diet, can have a pretty dramatic impact on the composition of the microbiota. And it also seems that that's true vice versa. That is, in some cases, the composition of the microbiota can impact what the food will do in terms of impacting the human. So that is to say, it appears certain architectures of the gut microbiota can extract maybe just a little bit more energy from the same amount of food, and that can cause, on one hand, you know, propensity towards obesity. And in other cases, when we look at malnutrition in countries where this is an issue, so Malawi and Bangladesh, for instance, they've shown that different types of microbiota architectures with the same food input can cause some kids to be more predisposed to malnutrition versus others.
And was there anything shown on specific food types or anything like that?
Yes, absolutely. And so this has been done in a few different ways. Certainly, you know, one thing we don't want to do is take something like obesity and take away the blame from ourselves.
Yes.
The microbiota only have a particular role to play. And so this is, of course, this shows that when you do eat extremely fatty and high caloric value foods, then you can still have two different microbiota architectures that will take those high-calorie foods and make one group of people more fat than others or more obese than others. Now, so if on the other hand, if you were to have a calorie-restricted lean diet, while you still see microbiota changes, you know, ultimately the amount of calories you eat has a larger role to play than your microbiota. The microbiota is almost like a catalyst, right? If you make healthy choices, there are cases where the microbiota can enhance that health benefit. If you make poor dietary choices, they can sometimes exacerbate that problem.
And can cultured foods work towards the beneficial degree?
I think the jury's out on that. So I think there's a lot of research that suggests that might be true. But I think, you know, for instance, there haven't been controlled clinical trials to show that cultured foods, or for instance, you know, things like, things that we're very familiar with. So, I mean, you know, a component being yogurt, where we talk about having active cultures in there. We recognize that there's probably some health benefit, but what we haven't been able to do yet is pinpoint why that specific bug, why that specific cultured organism has a positive benefit. So what I think.
Thank you, Gautam. We'll take one break. Thank you. Be back. Welcome back. So, Dr. Dantas, we were talking about cultured foods and. So what can we do as humans, as individuals, to sort of win this war on antibiotic resistance?
Sure. I think one of the things that we have to do is realize that it'll be a constant battle, and it's not something where we're going to find a magic bullet to solve the problem. So I think there are a few different obvious steps. One is clearly the continued development, research and development of new antibiotics and new antibiotic strategies. This is multi-pronged. This has to do with regulation. This has to do with, you know, government and industry incentives to develop these new drugs. And so, as I said at the very beginning, the most of the drugs we use in the clinic now were developed in the 1940s to the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
very few new drugs have come to market, and we need to try to solve that. And then the other side of the coin is that with the current drugs that we have, we need to be better stewards of them. We need to make sure both in the clinic and in agriculture that we try to be more prudent in our use of these life-saving chemotherapeutics. The more we abuse them, the more pressure we're going to give for resistance to come up. And so this means, you know, parents being smart and not demanding an antibiotic when their kids have the sniffles. Educating our doctors to be a little bit more resistant to those demands, to say, you know, this really is 99% a viral infection. Why don't we wait before I give you a big dose of antibiotics? And then in the agricultural industry, to consider restricting the use of these drugs, which we need in the clinic, for food animal agriculture. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think just the increased surveillance and study of resistance in different habitats. We've been a little bit myopically focused on resistance in the clinic, but that tends to then be reactionary. We find a new resistance gene, and then we start worrying about how to curb it. By looking at transmission dynamics, by looking at where these resistance genes live in the soil, in the commensal microbiota, maybe we can figure out the risk of these genes before we actually see them pop into pathogens.
And what about, potentially getting off of this antibiotic treadmill, phages or other options for dealing with bacterial infections?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So alternate therapies are things that we should absolutely investigate. Phage therapy is a little bit tricky because there still hasn't been a legitimate clinical trial on the use of phages. And there's also just the danger factor that people have to keep in mind, that while there's certainly, because phages control microbial populations and they're natural, there's always the risk that therapy could get out of hand. But it's absolutely something that we should be researching and finding out, you know, in limited situations, could we use something like that? There's another, a strategy that doesn't involve antibiotics that's quite enticing and exciting, and that is this notion of going after the pathogenicity of an organism and not over its ability to live. So most antibiotics work by trying to kill or restrict the growth of an organism. What if instead we design new drugs that instead just went after the part of the organism that causes the disease, the attachment or the toxin? So that could restrict pathogenesis without giving the high selection pressure for being antibacterial.
Thank you, and let's keep ourselves healthy. Thank you, Gautam.
Of course, my pleasure.
And thank you, Kristen. Thank you all out there for tuning in. This has been The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.